From Illinois Soul, this is Dialogue. I'm Kennedy Vincent. Dialogue is an exchange about culture, straight from the soul. You can catch us on Saturday mornings at 11 and Tuesdays at 7 p.m. on Illinois Soul.
We can't say anything negative about anybody's body image. Everyone's perfect.
Yes.
I don't agree. I think a bit of fat shaming is a good thing.
Do you think fat shaming works?
I think so.
Yes, because they start thinking that it is okay.
I'm a fat bitch.
I'm just going to keep eating. You can't tell me what to do.
Would you want
to
be fat?
Would I want to have more meat on my bones? Yeah, I'm flat everywhere.
Am I too much? Go find less.
Today on Dialogue, we're talking about fat individuals. Yes, fat. For centuries, the word fat has been used in negative, derogatory, and degrading ways. But what if that changed? What if the word fat can be reclaimed, empowered, and embraced? That's exactly what we'll be exploring in today's show, The Effects of Fat Phobia. Dr. Rashonda Breeden joins the conversation from the Fat on Campus Research Project.
Using the word fat actually helps to speak truth to power because there is nothing negative or rude in the word fat unless someone makes the effort to put it there. Unless the word fat is said with discrimination as the intent, that's the only way that it's negative. So for us, in just using it in casual conversation, it gives folks permission to do the same.
Two experts join us to talk more about how society has idealized thinness, how spaces and places are not designed for fat individuals, like college campuses or classrooms, and what it means to reimagine a world and shift our perspective to an inclusive society. Going to college is a major achievement. The time, energy, and money it takes to get in and work towards a degree is something many people in our country fight for. Yet, something as simple as attending class isn't always as welcoming for everyone as it may seem. That's why a group of researchers at the University of Georgia started a study called Fat on Campus. Their goal was to explore and understand the experiences of fat students on college and university campuses. Fat on Campus went from a research study to a national traveling exhibit and to a book by the same name. I sat down with one of the founders of the project, researcher Dr. Rashonda Breeden, to see how they came up with the idea and to learn more about the project.
We always get the question of why fat. I think most of the time people are uncomfortable with that language. They like to try to use more neutral language like curvy or fluffy. Like they try to find all of these ways to go around using the word fat. But on our team, we like to use the word fat because using the word fat actually helps to reclaim that language. And so you'll see in the field of fat studies, they are constantly finding ways to reclaim the word fat. And they want fat to be used as a neutral adjective, right? So we don't think that terms like short or tall are negative. We see those as neutral. We don't think young and old are negative. We see those as neutral. And the fat studies folk believe that fat should also be a neutral term. And it's actually the preferred term in fat study spaces. So we try to shy away from some of that, you know, fluffier language, no pun intended. And we don't even use words like overweight or obese because those words change with the times. But we like to center the F word that we say now, which is fat. And again, folks have told me, well, fat is just not, you know, socially acceptable or it's not polite. And we say, to whom? To whom is it not, you know? And so we ask those types of questions. But fat is the preferred term. Then we are reclaiming that word as a neutral adjective.
Yeah, thank you so much for breaking that down.
Yeah.
You received a grant in 2021 for this project, and you had 11 students across the U.S. partake in this Fat on Campus and research project. Yeah. Can you just take us through that journey for everyone?
So what we did was we put out flyers with our faces on them, not, you know, random photos of random people, but with our faces and our bodies on them, because as a team, we all identify as fat researchers. So we wanted the folks who were participating to know that they were in a community of a family, folks that understood. And when we sent the word out, we got about 19 different responses from folks that were just excited. They had never seen any type of study like this, and they were like, we want to be a part of it. And so we met with those 19 folks and just went over the study criteria. And we said, you know, fat is not a feeling, you know, either you're fat or you're not. So it's up to you to decide if you want to participate. And then we also asked folks to take pictures. And from there, that's how we got from 19 to 11. 11 folks were like, absolutely, yes, I'm going to do this. And we also paid them for their time. So after they took the pictures, we met with them over Zoom and they showed their photos, and they were able to just describe places on campus where they felt really, really comfortable in their bodies. And mostly it was like in their residence halls or in their apartment. And then they were able to talk about places that they did not feel comfortable in their bodies. And it was a lot of photos of chairs in classrooms, unfortunately. And we were so blown away by that because, you know, the college classroom is supposed to be a place where all students belong. But imagine, you know, making it all the way to college, being excited about your journey and being so uncomfortable in your chair in your classroom that you can't learn. And so a lot of students talked about that. They also talked about places like the dining hall, not feeling like they could get as much food as they wanted because they felt like eyes of other people looking at them. A lot of folks just talked about furniture feeling unsafe for their bodies, like sitting down in a seat and not knowing if the seat would hold them, and how, you know, that made them nervous. Other students talked about not even being able to get a college T-shirt. So for a lot of us, getting a campus T-shirt is a definitive moment, right? It says, like, I'm a student here and I belong here. But some students were not able to find sizes in their size. Like, some students were like, oh, there's not a 1X, there's not a 2X, there's not a 3X. And if there is, it says school dad or college dad. And they said they were not going to get one of those shirts. So that really contributed to them not feeling a sense of belonging because they couldn't even find their shirt in their size. So the students we met with were amazing. We met with some undergrad, some graduate students, and they talked about their experiences on campus. And then even after the fact, they were given recommendations. They were like, well, here's what we want campuses to do. We want campuses to think about us. We want campuses to consider our bodies. And they talked about campuses just not, you know, wanting them to be there. They said, honestly, some of the campuses just have never imagined that we would even be here. And so a lot of that sat with us as a research team. And so we decided to continue to invite collaborators into the journey, even after we had collected all the data. If there was any time that we were presenting the findings or even writing the book, there were times where we invited collaborators in the study who were participants to come along with us to either come to a workshop, help us put together workshop materials, help us figure out what findings were the most telling, or even help us write portions of the book. And so collaborators have been with us essentially every step of the way.
A Fat Black Woman Goes Shopping by Grace Nichols. Shopping in London winter is a real drag for the fat black woman, going from store to store in search of accommodating clothes and the weather so cold. Look at the frozen thin mannequins fixing her with grin, and the pretty faced sales girls exchanging slimming glances thinking she don't notice. Lord, this is aggravating. Nothing soft and bright and billowing to flow like breezy sunlight when she walking. The fat black woman curses in Swahili, Yoruba, a nation language under her breathing, all this journeying and journeying. The fat black woman could only conclude that when it comes to fashion, the choice is lean. Nothing much beyond size 14.
let's talk about fat phobia. Fat phobia is the implicit and explicit bias of overweight individuals that is rooted in a sense of blame and presumed moral failing. But the harsh reality of fat phobia didn't come out of a need to sell diet pills. It's rooted in systems of oppression that dates back to before America was even founded. The dialogue team started to think, what are the ways in which Black individuals are socialized to think about their bodies? I spoke with Dr. Shakara Hamilton, a licensed clinical psychologist at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, to learn more.
Most of my work and my research has been around the United States of America and the Black experience in the United States of America. And so I want to highlight that there is no monolith of Black people and their experience with body weight and food and body image. And from my experience and what I've known thus far, I do think weight and body image has had a very difficult history for Black people who are descendants of the enslaved folks who were brought here through the transatlantic slave trade. I think one example is how often that Black bodies have been displayed across time. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the stereotypes that a lot of Black women specifically are portrayed as, like the sapphire, which I think a lot of people would know as like the angry Black woman stereotype. Like think about Miss Pat from the Miss Pat show, if you've seen that.
Mm-hmm.
Or I think about the Mammy. So the movie The Help, Abilene, she was dedicated. She was not sexually oriented at all. She was dedicated in a very servant role to the family that she was working with. Or you think about a Jezebel. I think that would remind me of stereotypes like in the show P-Valley, Mercedes. She's very hypersexualized and uses her sexuality, and it's portrayed in this negative way to like manipulate people and get things that she wants. And I think in a lot of ways, historically, Black women have been categorized based on body shape into specific categories or based on specific characteristics that they display. And I think a lot of beauty standards that are not inherent to African-American and Black bodies. Like from when I was growing up in the South, I grew up with curvaceous women. That was just what I grew up around. And my family was always conscious about making sure that I knew that that was okay. I was very fortunate that weight was not something that I needed to worry about.
Mm-hmm.
But I also had peers who their families wanted to make sure that they were in smaller bodies because the standard or the default has become thinner bodies. That is the default, right? When you go into a store, you're gonna see smalls, mediums, larges, extra larges if you're lucky. But those 2Xs, 3Xs, 4Xs, 5Xs, you either have to special order them or they're in a different section of the store. So that thin ideal has become the norm. And I think, unfortunately, because of the ideals that are the default, a lot of women, especially Black women, their shoe size is a 7.5, 8, but society tells them it should be a 6. And so they will try to alter through whatever means and put themselves into that. And when you feel like, oh my goodness, I'm not a size 6, you will do any of the things that you can to do. And that is where you can get disordered eating. That is when you can get cosmetic surgeries. And there is no inherent goodness or badness to any of those things. But I do think it plays a part into why a lot of folks may not recognize that they have disordered eating because it's seen as a positive thing, something that has a purpose.
Dr. Hamilton mentioned something important, disordered eating. When we talk about the power and benefits fat on campus creates when amplifying voices of fat individuals and imagery to our fatphobic society, it's about more than just reclaiming the word fat. Advocating for a more inclusive society, infrastructure, and language can also save lives. Research shows that fat shaming and social stigma against fat bodies contributes to a rise in eating disorders. According to the National Association of Anorexia Nervosa and Associated Disorders, fewer than 6% of people with eating disorders are medically diagnosed as underweight. In fact, people in larger bodies are at the highest risk of having developed an eating disorder in their lives. anorexia has the highest case of mortality rate of any mental illness. There is one death every 52 minutes as a result of an eating disorder. Dr. Hamilton is on the eating disorders outreach team at the UIUC. She explains what disordered eating is, and she breaks down what a clinical eating disorder looks like.
A lot of people maybe don't think about disordered eating behaviors and feelings as having a purpose, but you wouldn't do something if it didn't serve some kind of purpose. And so we normally start there by just acknowledging and appreciating, though this isn't adaptive for you anymore, at some point, somewhere, it was your life raft for whatever you were going through. And so we have to figure out what purpose it served so that we can help you get that need met otherwise. And then we can go from there. So I really love the disordered eating skills group that I get to co-lead at the counseling center, because we really talk about it in a very direct way that also honors that this disordered eating behavior, it represented something or might still represent something for you or gives you access to something like social capital. Well, if I don't do this, how am I going to have friends? Or if I'm in a larger body, or if I become fat, how am I going to fit in with everybody else, right? There's a lot of reasons people engage in disordered eating behaviors. And so I really appreciate being in this space. I also love talking about it because I think a lot of it is really from a pathological standpoint, like eating disorders versus disordered eating.
Break that down for us too, please.
So for eating disorders, I think about that as something that is a clinical manifestation, right? Like this is something that meets a diagnosable criteria for something that is typically in the DSM-5, whichever the most current edition is. But you can also have disordered eating behavior. So your relationship with food and or your body isn't really healthy, but it doesn't meet clinical criteria to make a diagnosis. That does not mean, though, you're not still struggling and you don't need to work on that. It would be like saying, I have anxiety that's significant versus I have an anxiety disorder, right? Both of them can be causing you distress. One of them can give you a clinical diagnosis, but that doesn't make your anxiety that is not giving you a diagnosis any less distressing. So we just need to make sure that we're talking about it in a holistic way, because it also looks different, right? If I have disordered eating as a Black woman from the South, that might look really different than someone who has disordered eating who is Asian American, who's an international student, right? The cultural differences make a big difference. And so what you consider an eating disorder is also going to vary based on your frame of reference. But we can typically all agree that disordered eating can look a lot of different ways when people have a very strict idea about eating disorders.
So how can having more representation of fat bodies and inclusive infrastructure benefit the mental and physical health of people?
I think one part about that is representation shows you that people thought about you, and not just in a passive way. We didn't say, oh yeah, of course we want you here. Right. No, we have integrated you into the fabric of our, let's say, program, so much so that we wanted to make sure that you knew that you're represented here, that people who look like you, who have names like you, who sound like you, do belong here and do great work here. That is a very different thing. To have someone who looks like me, talks like me, has aspects like me integrated into a program versus added on top, that is a very different feeling. To be interwoven into the fabric of a place versus added on like an adornment that you can change as the wind blows you makes a big, big difference. We've heard all the research about how representation matters, so I will not belabor those facts anymore. But I will just say representation matters, especially when you think that no one sees you. I think in a lot of ways, people that are fat and in larger bodies may feel invisible or just othered or not seen. I loved the project Fat on Campus because it really brought to the forefront a lot of things that I don't think a lot of people who aren't in disordered eating and or body image work think about. How many people think about those little desks with the chairs with the desks attached, about that being uncomfortable? How many people think about making random seating charts, right? They try to do that to to make sure people aren't cheating at academic integrity. But if my body doesn't sit in this chair that I have to sit in, right? I think not because of maliciousness. I just think a lot of those things are invisible for people, that it doesn't impact on a regular basis because we're not socialized to think about those things. So now I'm not invisible. And that shows that you see that I have value here and I have worth here. My four-year-old watches Gracie's Corner and she says she's going to be a doctor. And I'm like, absolutely, absolutely. Because she knows that as possible, because she sees Black doctors everywhere. She knows that's possible for her because she sees that reflected in her. I think a lot of people don't take into account how much we are visual people. And what we see reflected back to us is what we then feel like we can aspire to.
This idea of how we are socialized from a young age to think about weight is something I also brought up with Dr. Breeden. I wanted to know how she navigated her own internalized ideas around weight when working on this project and what body positivity means to her.
On our research team, we did a lot to unpack our own relationship to the Fat on Campus project. And some of the work that I had to do was unpack how I grew up, how I had parents or either grandparents who made remarks about my body as a kid and about whether or not I was desirable as a kid, right? Which is problematic in all the ways. But how that led to unhealthy relationships with people and unhealthy relationships to food and unhealthy relationships to my body. And so I think the whole Fat on Campus project, we as researchers had to do that work, and the collaborators that we met with, a lot of them talked about the relationship that they had been on personally related to fat phobia, related to even just being okay with calling themselves fat, related to unhealthy relationships they had with other people on campus. And a lot of them were finding healing in this work. I know I found a lot of healing in the work. In the book, one of the chapters, I think it's chapter 8, where we're talking about fatness and other identities, sort of an intersectional approach. I'm writing a lot about what I learned as a fat Black woman from my parents, or particularly my mom. And so we had to do a lot of self-work to unlearn a lot of those negative behaviors. And I think about college students today, there's so much on social media related to thinness and beauty. And there's a lot of problematic language related to being fat, the whole unbig my back scenarios and things like that. And so I'm hoping that this project, this book, all of the conversations that we're having around fat phobia, it's really able to get to young adults and students to let them know that they're not alone. We see you, and your body is a good body, regardless of what society tells you about your body.
Yes, for yourself, for other people who are involved in the Fat on Campus research, to find healing within this and to unlearn so you can relearn is just so powerful. And I'm happy you said all that, because it kind of leads me into my next question. And I'm just going to riff a few things off, so whichever way you want to take it. But what does body positivity look like? What does it look like when you're Black? What does it look like when you're in a different social class? What does it look like loving yourself, being comfortable in your body?
Yeah, let's break that down. So a lot of times that whole space is majority white. And I know a lot of folks who look like me, sound like me, don't always fit into body positive spaces. And so what we're telling folks is, like, you don't have to have a positive view of your body, but you should know that regardless of if you're feeling positive or negative about your body is a good body. All bodies are good. Your body literally woke you up this morning. Your body will go to sleep at night, hopefully. Your body has sustained you through, you know, disordered eating, through stress, through hardship. And so it's just having people just think differently about their bodies, not as something that needs to be fixed, but as something that has carried you through and something that is deserving of care. Like, your body, regardless of where you are, old, young, thin, fat, short, tall, your body is a body that's deserving of care wherever you are. And so that is the message that we hope to get to people. Not necessarily positivity, but your body is deserving of care.
So for you personally, why and how have you found your purpose in this work?
Personally, I am a Black woman. I live in a larger body, so I'm a fat person. I'm from a low-income background. I'm a first-generation college student. My closest sibling has a disability, and so I'm also a caregiver. And so I live in the margins of society a lot of times. A lot of times I'm having to work to bring myself center. And even as a college student, I felt like an outsider. And so I do this work so that I can help students that also feel like outsiders, students who might be poor, students who might be working class, students who might be first generation college students, students who might be minoritized in any capacity. I do this work so that they can feel brought to center, so they can feel like they belong, so they can feel like somebody is understanding of their struggle. And I get emails, text messages, or people will even come up to conferences saying, you know, where do you get the gumption to speak truth to power in the way you do? Like, where do you get the audacity to say what you say in articles? And honestly, a lot of it is my own lived experience. So if telling my story or telling minoritized stories helps to amplify the voices of students like me, I'm going to do it every single time, even if I face potential backlash.
Ms. Third Ward, your first question. What is your aspiration in life?
Oh, my aspiration in life would be to be happy.
Listening to how Dr. Breeden empowered her own experience and is now helping other individuals around the country do the same is inspiring, but it doesn't stop there. She told me she wants people who are listening to think about the spaces around them, because learning about it isn't enough. There has to be action.
I want to bring us back to words that one of the collaborators, her name is Serena, shared with us, that college campuses don't want fat bodies here because they never imagined fat bodies here. And they're very okay with us being uncomfortable because they don't see us as human. And no matter what the university or what other people try to tell you to bypass that fact, it is still a fact. And so I lean on her words to say that fat students feel as though higher education does not see them as human. And so what do we need to do? I think stakeholders on college campuses and beyond need to see fat folks as human, all folks, all minoritized folks, all bodies as human and deserving of care. And folks need to think about, how do college campuses inherently fat phobic? What kind of physical pain might students have to go through? What kind of mental anguish might students be thinking about in the classroom? What kind of health and safety implications are in the classroom and on the college campuses? And then what can we do about that? I want folks to start thinking about, like, if you view fatness as a moral issue, I want folks to pause and consider why. And then ask yourself, how am I contributing to belonging in higher ed or harm in higher ed for fat folks?
Dr. Roshonda Breeden, thank you so much for joining me. The work you're doing is so inspiring, and I definitely hope and pray that this conversation continues outside of this conversation.
Yes, it feels so good for all folks. We've had folks in all bodies just talk about what they learned from the work and how they've been changed by the work. And we just want y'all to continue to talk about this. And don't be afraid, y'all, to use fat, okay? And it's a neutral descriptor. If you don't do anything else from this episode, that is a neutral descriptor, and it's okay to use it, and it's okay for us to reclaim that language.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. You're incredible.
Thank you.
To see photos and read personal statements from the Fat on Campus Project, visit fat.com. oncampus.com. You can find their book, Fat on Campus, the voices and images of fat college students and the impacts of fat phobia, online or wherever you get your books. If you're on the UIUC campus and struggle with ideas around weight, or you're looking into mental health services, visit Dr. Hamilton at the UIUC Counseling Center. A special thank you to Dr. Shakara Hamilton and to Dr. Rashonda Breeden for joining us in this conversation and the advocacy work that they do. I'm Kennedy Vincent, and you're currently listening to Dialogue on Illinois Soul. Stay with us after this short break.